Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Richard Jackman, the current convener of the Economics Department, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to this special lecture being given by Paul Krugman this evening. This is, a great opportunity to welcome back to the school so many of our former students from the Economics Department from all our various different programs. We're very keen to foster a strong network of alumni, both in the UK, in Europe, and throughout the world. And by arranging these events, we hope to provide our alumni with access to topical speakers from both from our own department and from visitors to the school, such as Professor Krugman. Professor Krugman is, in fact, not just a visitor, but a visiting centennial professor. These are positions that were created just at the turn of the millennium, actually, people we hoped would maintain a continuing relationship with the school, despite not being on our own faculty, and we're very pleased that Professor Krugman is such a distinguished person. Professor Krugman is also, of course, Professor of Economics and International Affairs at Princeton University. He has a very considerable professional reputation on account of substantial and a very large number of contributions, particularly in the area of international trade and finance. He's one of the founders of the new trade theory, which is one area in which this department has done considerable work, and one of our, one of our strengths here as well. He's currently mostly, his academic research currently is mostly focused on economic and currency crises. In addition to all this, of course, Professor Krugman is also extremely famous because he writes every week a column in the New York Times, which is one of the great conduits for bringing economic analysis to bear in a way that influences and affects public opinion, and is the sort of thing which I think we very much miss not having in this country as well. It's really tremendous that an outstanding academic economist is at the forefront of the public debate. So we're very pleased that you're here. The lecture now will be on the subject of deflation and all that, and after the lecture there will be time for questions, and after that we will have a reception in the atrium just across the way, and very much hope to see you there, and we can discuss any further matters to do with the department after the lecture. But in the meantime, may I welcome Paul Krugman here and invite him to give the lecture on deflation and all that. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks. I gave a somewhat silly sounding title for the lecture, partly because I've been talking and worrying about this stuff a lot, and it does, after a while, you get used to it. But I'm a little bit serious as well. I'm going to talk about deflation and all that, meaning all the stuff that is associated with the deflation issue. And one of the morals of all this is that the all that is actually more important than the deflation per se. So it's an issue that has finally sprung into the public consciousness, finally started being a subject of regular articles in good newspapers, but it's still mostly people are missing the point and focusing on the deflation rather than the stuff that makes deflation potentially important, the stuff that surrounds it. Let me just say, if you're an academic with some interest in real world issues, there are three kinds of problems that crop up. There are problems that are intellectually interesting, but not particularly crucial to debate, to actual policy or real world debate right now. Then there are issues that are really relevant, important in terms of current debate, but are not intellectually interesting. And then once in a rare while, you get an issue which turns out to be both intellectually interesting and also relevant to debate. And of course, at various times in my life, I find myself working on all three kinds. So I've the kind of work that I hope will be remembered in the long term is work on questions like why is there international trade, which is very interesting intellectually, but it's not something that's going to change a bill now before Congress. So it's type one. Stuff that's important but not interesting is what I deal with all the time in my newspaper columns. Unfortunately, there's nothing intellectually interesting about most of the debates. Most of them could be settled by a 10th grade student, or many of them involve nothing more than trying to insist that 2 + 2 really does equal 4, not 6 or 0. If you ask, well, why don't people understand that? One of my favorite quotes from the American writer Upton Sinclair is, it's very difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it. So that stuff is necessary but not fun. But deflation and the surrounding issue happens to be both interesting and important, and so it's quite a lot of fun. And professionally, as a citizen of the United States, I'm quite upset to see that we actually seem to be skirting on the edge of having some of these problems ourselves. Professionally, I'm delighted because it means that stuff that I've been worrying about for a while and is really very interesting has now become not only something that those of us who worry about events abroad care about, but also part of the domestic scene. Okay, the issues, there are really two interrelated issues. One is the issue of deflation, of a persistent fall in prices, which at the moment can be seen in only a few places in the world and is not yet happening in the United States. And if we're lucky, won't happen, but the fact that we even have to trust to luck for it not to happen tells you how serious it's become. The other is the issue sometimes called the zero bound, the old phrase for it is liquidity trap. And it really refers to a situation in which ordinarily the ordinary tools of monetary policy, the ordinary tools that Greenspan or Duesenberg or George can deploy, have lost their effectiveness. And it's really that second issue that is crucial, but it both plays into and interacts with deflation in a way that might be very, very serious. Those of you, anybody who knows stuff I've written on this or has followed this in general, knows that all of these issues reemerged into our consciousness about 1998, but they should have emerged about 1995, and they emerged in Japan. So let me talk a little bit about the story of Japan, and then a little bit about antecedents and where it applies. Okay, Japan was, of course, the wonder of the world economy. Actually, it is again the wonder of the world economy, but in a different way. In the 80s, it was a miracle economy growing extremely rapidly. Everything seemed to be going right, and there was much praise for Japanese management, both private and policy. Do people read Dilbert here? There was a classic Dilbert cartoon with the manager who reads too many management theory books and is always exhorting his employees to re-engineer the search for excellence and the total quality chaos or whatever it is the Japanese are doing this week. That was the way things seemed in the early 90s. Okay, bubble turns. At the time, people offered all kinds of rationales for why the Nikkei should have tripled in the course of 5 years, and all sorts of rationales for why the value of the land under Tokyo should be worth more than the state of California. It was, as it turned out, indeed a bubble. It burst. And that was then followed by what at first seemed to be relatively ordinary problems. There was a recession. It wasn't a very severe recession. There was a recovery, which was kind of a mild recovery, not very impressive. There was another recession. There was no Argentine or Indonesian style. The bottom fell out and all hell broke loose. There were just a series of economic disappointments. But circa 1995, two things, which we hadn't seen for a very long time, became true of the Japanese economy. The first was that by some measures, broadly measured prices were starting to fall. Not by all. So if you actually look for deflation in the official Japanese consumer price index, you really have to come up till the very end of the 90s. By GDP deflate or whatever, it was certainly very low rates of inflation and by some measures deflation, which was something we hadn't seen in an advanced country for a long time. The other was that interest rates reached levels that haven't been seen anywhere for a very long time. That the call money rate, which is roughly the equivalent of the Fed funds rate in the U.S., was pushed below 1%. And the economy remained depressed, not deeply depressed, but clearly operating below capacity. What do these two things have to do with each other? The basic thing to say about deflation is that ordinarily it oughtn't to be a problem. It ought to be something which, if you don't like it, is very easy to cure. Inflation is difficult to cure, not technically difficult, because it's quite easy to just basically cut off the supply of money, but it's extremely unpleasant. If you have an inflationary economy, under some circumstances the inflation is there because the government needs to print money to pay its bills, but in advanced economies normally you have an inflation because you've stumbled into it one way or another, and the trouble is that trying to bring it down means experiencing a recession, downturn. Temporarily, we now think, but it's painful to do that. So if you look at the end of serious inflation in the United States, well, we basically achieved that in the first half of the 1980s, and we did it by driving the unemployment rate up to a peak of almost 11% when the norm was between 5 and 6, and only after the unemployment rate had been extremely high for an extended period of time were we able to achieve more, really, you know, low single-digit inflation. Inflation is hard to end because ending inflation is painful. Deflation, on the other hand, well, if your prices are falling and you think that's a bad idea, well, just print more money. And printing more money ought to be an enjoyable experience all around. You get to a little bit of senior rich for the government. Again, we're not supposed to worry about that in advanced countries. But also, you typically get an expansion of the economy. So ending deflation ought to be easy, pleasant. And for that reason, you wouldn't expect deflation to ever really be an issue. The only cases in which there would be a deflation that you would have difficulty in fighting would be if you have some kind of constraint on the central bank. And of course, those do happen. So if I looked at the situation in Hong Kong, which is experiencing deflation right now, well, there isn't a whole lot that the Hong Kong Monetary Authority can do because without a fundamental change in policy, without abandoning the currency board and the peg to the U.S. dollar. So they have tied their own hands and they don't have an easy answer. If we look at Germany, which is now being on the IMF's latest report, they basically give the biggest red flag for deflation to Germany. Well, the problem is Germany doesn't have its own currency anymore. So they don't have a monetary policy. But barring that, you would expect deflation to be easily solved. Except if printing money has lost its effectiveness. And the way that can happen, of course, is if interest rates are already really quite close to zero, so that you cannot push them significantly lower. And that's the liquidity trap. If for whatever reason it turns out that an interest rate close to zero, or specifically a short-term interest rate, because that's what you have the direct impact on, it close to zero, is not low enough to get the economy up to full employment, not low enough to get you back to a situation where prices start to rise again, then you're in a liquidity trap, and you may have difficulty dealing with a situation of deflation. If you had asked me 10 years ago, maybe even 6 or 7 years ago, I would have said that's just not a realistic possibility. And if you probably asked most economists, they would have also said it's not a realistic possibility. If you had looked very hard, if you had a good knowledge of economic history, you might say, wait, what about the 1930s? Because in fact, in the 30s in the US, the short-term interest rates were very close to zero. So you might have asked, well, you know, isn't that a real possibility? But I guess the general view among professional economists in the US was that the 30s liquidity trap never really happened, and furthermore, it wouldn't happen again. That it was something that we thought we'd been informed by Milton Friedman that it was dereliction by the Fed that was responsible for the Great Depression and deflation in the 30s, and that we knew what it would take not to have that happen again. Then, of course, we found ourselves with a real live liquidity trap in Japan. And gradually building up, at this point, real live persistent deflation that is not responding to monetary policy, which tells us all that it's not a myth from our grandfather's time. It's something that can really happen. It can happen to an advanced economy with a reasonably sophisticated government. And it can happen, what's also interesting is it can happen to an economy that faces none of the usual constraints on its policy. The difference between deflation in Hong Kong and deflation in Japan is that Hong Kong has a currency board, and even if it didn't, you might say, well, the very openness of the economy, the smallness of it, means that there are limits to it, to the, what the policy can do. But Japan is essentially as closed, as self-sufficient an economy as the U.S. or the Eurozone. It doesn't have foreign debt. It has massive foreign assets. It has got full flexibility of policy, as much as any economy can ever have. And yet, it's been stuck in this situation. Let me just, a few more words about liquidity traps. One of the reasons why liquidity trap conditions are interesting, why they're fun, I'm sorry to say this, but why they're terrible. Looks somber, but they are fun to study, is that they bring you into this sort of looking glass world where virtues are vices and up is down. So if we ask, what are the problems with Japan? We say, well, those Japanese consumers, they save too much. Thrift is definitely a vice in a deflationary economy. You say, well, if only we could convince people that there would be inflation, that would help. And I probably unhelpfully suggested that what the Japanese central bank needs to do is to credibly promise to be irresponsible. And that doesn't go down very well, but it's in fact what you would need. I'll talk a little bit in a while about what you do if you do find yourself in a full Japanese situation. Let me talk first about one more thing I wanted to say. Once you realize that it's a real life possibility in the modern world, you also realize that our grandfathers weren't that stupid after all. You realize that on several levels. One is that you go back to old writings, which 10 years ago looked primitive and as if people just didn't understand, and all of a sudden you say, oh, that kind of looks, now I see what they were talking about. One thing I'd recommend to anyone who's interested in sort of modern history of economic thought, it is possible now to buy a reprint of the original 1948 edition of Samuelson's Economics, exactly as it was, except not falling apart. And the discussion of monetary policy there from a 1990 perspective looks extremely weird, because he's extremely skeptical about the ability of the Federal Reserve to effectively fight recessions. And he goes through about how, well, interest rates are barely above 1%, and what can you do if you try to push more money into the system? People will probably just add it to their cash balances, and it really won't have any significant effect on spending. And after decades of being taught about the importance of monetary policy, that all seemed very strange. But now, of course, in the United States, the Fed it's Thursday, right? Yesterday cut rates to the Fed funds rate to 1%. And so we're basically back in that world that Samuelson was talking about. The other thing that you realize is that what you may have heard about the 1930s and the failures of monetary policy, it may be giving too little credit to the people of the time. One of the great discoveries, and it was important, that was made by Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz in their monetary history of the U.S., is that definitions of money that generally work relatively well, or used to work relatively well as in predicting economic movements, tend to be broad measures, things like M2. And during the 1930s, M2 fell a lot. And so the conclusion that they gave you was that the Great Depression was the result of the Fed's negligence in allowing M2 to fall a great deal. And if it hadn't done that, we wouldn't have had the Great Depression. You look at Japan now, and you see that M2 refuses to grow. that the Bank of Japan has been rapidly increasing what it does actually control, which is the monetary base, but that M2 doesn't expand. And if you once you start to think about the reality of a world with near zero interest rates, that's not surprising. If the interest rate a bank can get by lending out money is almost zero, if you increase that bank's reserves, why would it be in any hurry to lend them out? If you do get the money into people's hands, why, from their point of view, cash and short-term bonds are basically the same thing, why would they feel that an increase in their holdings of cash makes them more willing to spend? You would actually expect a disconnect between base money, which is what the central bank controls, and M2, which is the measure that Friedman and Schwartz used to measure monetary policy. So you start to say, well, wait a second, maybe even if you transported Milton Friedman back to 1931 and gave him control of the Fed, he would not actually have been able to prevent the Great Depression, that he would have discovered to his horror that whatever he did, M2 just kept on falling. So it does suggest a big reinterpretation. Okay, so where are we now? We're in a situation, Japan is in a situation where it is having slowly accelerating deflation and also appears to be quite firmly stuck in the liquidity trap. And what you realize when you think about the logic is that this is, at least potentially, and appears to be in practice, a mutually reinforcing process. If you have a deflationary environment, then at any given interest rate, people become less willing to borrow, become less willing to spend, because they expect the real value of their debt to grow, because they expect to have to repay any borrowing in no more nominal yen than they received, but in more real yen than they were able to spend. If you have now ordinarily under ordinary circumstances, changes in the rate of inflation, if you have an alert central bank, are reflected one for one in changes in the interest rate, changes in the expected rate of inflation, because they're offset by movement in the interest rate. But if the interest rate is hard up against a lower bound, I'll say zero for a minute, but I'll explain in a moment that that's not what we think is really the bound. But in Japan, at least, the call money rate is zero. If the expected rate of inflation falls, that if it goes from -1 to -2, there's nothing the Bank of Japan can do. It can't bring the nominal interest rate down any further, so that the growing expectations of deflation are a contractionary impact on the economy, one to which the Bank of Japan can't respond. And of course, on the other side, as the economy becomes more depressed, the deflationary pressure tends to grow. And so we have at least potentially, and again in Japan it appears to be the truth, a deflationary spiral developing in which falling inflation rates cause the economy to become more depressed, and an increasingly depressed economy leads to still further deflation. Okay, some of us who were internationally sensitized began paying a lot of attention to Japan in the late 90s, realizing that this showed that this was a real issue, began talking about, well, what can they do now since they are already in the liquidity trap? And I'll come back to that in a moment. The question that always lingered was, well, if it can happen to Japan, might it happen to anyone else? And the general view was, well, not us. And again, a little bit of that syndrome, go back, knowing what we know now, you look at the 1930s and you think, well, we would never have made the mistakes that got us into the Great Depression. You look at Japan and you say, well, they must have been foolish and unresponsive in their policies. Okay, there's been a landmark study by economists at the Federal Reserve of how Japan got into the mess. And it's very interesting because it shows that they were not stupid. It shows that, in fact, people here may know about Taylor rules, but anyway, if you took the forecasts that they were making all through that first half of the 90s, all during the period when they slid into a as we now know, a deflationary liquidity trap, if you took the forecast they had of growth and inflation, their monetary policy was entirely reasonable. Their monetary policy was about what normal central bank operating procedure would have led you to do. Furthermore, their forecasts were not out of line with independent forecasts. If you take a look at what the at what private sector forecasters were saying was going to happen to the economy, they were similar to what the Bank of Japan and well, at that point, the Ministry of Finance was predicting. The trouble was that the forecast kept on being wrong. And the cumulative effect of the economy always having lower inflation and lower growth than people expected was that, that again, repeatedly doing what seemed to be the reasonable thing, they ended up by 1995 or so with no real policy options left on monetary policy. And there they were. So it suggests that if you are concerned about liquidity trap, if you're concerned about a Japanese-style scenario, you better take out some insurance. You better act very quickly if you think we're getting anywhere near to that, to try and get the economy moving, keep the inflation rate up comfortably above zero so that it's not going to happen. So when the United States experienced its own bubble bursting, the Fed understood that and took the lesson to heart and moved very rapidly to goose up the economy, and in other words, did everything thinking that well, we're not going to fall into the Japanese syndrome. Well, you know what's happened. At this point, just to give you the story, the Federal Reserve has now cut rates 13 times. It's come down from 6.5% on the Fed funds rate to 1 as of yesterday. The economy has not plunged. There was a brief severe downturn, but didn't go on very long. And since then, it has grown, but not grown fast enough. And I hope this is going to be a little. I was trying to unsuccessfully to persuade the BLS website to give me a bigger chart, but that's just showing the U.S. unemployment rate. Now, what you can see is that the unemployment rate is, the hatched area to the right is since the beginning of the recession in 2001. The unemployment rate is not high by historical standards, but it has not fallen. It has, in fact, continued to rise despite the fact that the economy is growing, because the economy is growing too slowly. We now think, in a way, this is... productivity isn't a bad thing, but if you have high productivity growth, then you need to grow fairly quickly to keep up with the combination of productivity growth and labor force growth, and we're not doing so. For what it's worth, just technical thing, it's probably worse than the numbers suggest. There's something funny about the U.S. employment statistics. The other measures, payroll, measures taken from the employment side as opposed to the survey of households, suggest that the job picture ought to be a lot worse than the measured unemployment rate. There seems to be an awful lot of people dropping out of the labor force who are probably in reality frustrated but aren't showing up as measured unemployed. What that says is that the Fed has done all it could, or almost all it could. It's responded very rapidly. The rate at which interest rates came down is much faster than that of Japan. In the first half of the 90s. Nonetheless, we're about out of monetary ammunition, at least as conventionally measured, and we're looking a little problematic. One other slide. Do we have deflation? Well, not yet. The core inflation rate, that's taking out food and energy. This is starting from the beginning of the recession in March 2001, has been falling. It's down a little over about a percentage point. You'll sometimes see people say, well, don't worry, you know, there's no prospect anytime soon that the U.S. will actually have deflation. And that's true, but it is also true that the inflation rate's down, which means that that an interest rate, a given nominal interest rate is a higher real interest rate than it was a year ago. So we are possibly in this problem. How close are we to the Japanese situation, really, truly? Well, we still have another 100 basis points to cut. But I'm told And I have no way to make any... people claim to understand these things. They actually think that the practical limit on the Fed funds rate is 0.75%. And the story supposedly is that anything below that and the mutual fund industry shrivels up and dies. And the Fed believes that that does more harm than the good you would get out of those extra 75 basis points. So effectively, we're there. Effectively, you know, the Fed could do another quarter point cut, but that would hardly make a difference. If we're lucky, good stuff happens, and we happen to be carried away by a favorable wind from the reef that we're dangerously close to, maybe. Or if we're not lucky, we're essentially in a Japanese situation. What do you do? I'm sorry, before I say what do you do, let's just talk for a second about how can this happen. I gave a more economistic version of this talk recently. All the days are blurring together, I think. But the very good question was, why now? Why are these things happening when they didn't happen for all these years? Why has it taken 60 years for us to have a 1930s type problem again? I think there are two answers to that. One of them is that, maybe three, among the answers, Monty Python always comes to the rescue here. One answer is that we did have the biggest bubbles since the 20s. First the Japanese bubble economy of the 80s and then the U.S. bubble economy of the 90s. So we had two enormous bubbles. And if you want to ask why we had those enormous bubbles, that would be a further inquiry. But we certainly had run-ups in stock prices that make previous notions of what a big financial bubble looks like seem silly. You don't get broad-based tripling of stock prices in large economies between 1930 and the 1980s in Japan and the 1990s in the U.S. So that creates room for a lot of stuff to go wrong. And in the case of the United States, what we seem to have had is the combination of inflated demand, which suddenly went away when the bubble burst in stock prices, and also a large excessive investment by certain kinds of business and excessive buildup of debt. Above all, telecoms seems to be the biggest single thing. And so in some sense, the WorldCom and all of that is part of the story. Second thing is that for most of the post-war period, we had persistent problems with inflation. And if you have an economy that goes into a recession with a 5% or a 7% rate of inflation, it's much less likely to find itself up against the 0.75 lower bound than if you go into the recession with an inflation rate of only 2%. So the very success of economic policy in the 90s in getting rid, finally, of the persistent inflation that we'd had for the previous several decades set us up for a different kind of problem in the new millennium. I guess the third thing, which I'm not entirely clear about, but there's some sense that all of the deregulation opening up of economies that we've had has, with many benefits in terms of microeconomic efficiency, has also possibly increased macroeconomic volatility. That in some sense we had a laissez-faire freebooting economy in the 20s, which left us open to the Great Depression. We clamped down, regulated, controlled, and so we got something that didn't have that kind of volatility. By the 1980s, we realized that free markets are good things and deregulation is often a good idea, and we opened things up, and so we replicated the conditions that we'd had 70 years before. All right, what do you do? The obvious answer, the straightforward answer, if you're caught in this situation where monetary policy has lost its effectiveness, is to rely on the other tool of economic policy, which is fiscal policy. Now, there we have a disturbing precedent, which is, of course, the Japanese have done that. And it would be wrong, I think, to say that it has been ineffectual. The fact is that Japan, although in terms of interest rates, in terms of deflation, looks like a 30s economy, It has not experienced the 30s style downturn. One of the weird experiences, if you know the Japanese data and then you go to Tokyo, this doesn't look like the depths of a Great Depression. Now, I'm told that if you can actually go out some distance from Tokyo to other towns, it looks more depressed. But nonetheless, it clearly has not. The fact is the Japanese economy has grown on average about 1% a year since it entered into this trap. That's not enough. That's a growing amount of slack in the economy, but it's not a severe downturn. And the reason, presumably, is all of that spending. Japan pours about as much concrete each year as the United States does, with less than half the population. And that's all of those bridges to nowhere and dams and the 60% of the coast is now armored, I think, and all of which creates a lot of employment and keeps the economy afloat. What it hasn't done, there are two ways in which that could be a long-term solution. One of them would be if it was a bridge, not a bridge to nowhere, but a bridge to an economic recovery. If you had a temporary period when, despite zero interest rates, you couldn't get the economy reflated, employing a lot of people on public works could tide you over until businesses were ready to invest again. The other is if you had pump priming. That's the old metaphor. Doesn't work so well because nobody in the modern world knows what that means. Jump starting. If a temporary period of strong fiscal stimulus could get you moving into a self-sustaining recovery, that would be good. The trouble is that there's been no sign of that. We don't know, really, whether that's because it's just a flawed idea or whether it just hasn't been big enough. And the classic example of a pump priming that gets you out of a deflationary trap, expansionary fiscal policy, we had a rather large public works program in the first half of the 1940s, otherwise known as World War II, and if you want the scale of it, in fiscal 43, the U.S. Federal deficit was 28% of GDP. So if it takes something on that scale to boot you out, the Japanese haven't tried that. The United States, I continue to, about to say believe, hope, that the U.S. actually doesn't have a full Japanese problem, that the Japanese persistent inadequate demand has a lot to do with demography, very low birth rate and absence of immigration, and also persistent high savings behavior, possibly structural problems, although I think there's much too much emphasis on structural reform as an answer to business cycle problems. But still, that the U.S. is in better shape, and we would be, you would hope that we would be able to have a bridging fiscal policy that would work, that if we can just hold out for another 2 years or so, by that time businesses will be ready to start investing again and we would be okay. So that in that case, it would be quite straightforward, and anybody, I think any smart undergraduate could easily devise a sensible bridging fiscal policy for the U.S. Of course, we're not getting that, and that brings me back to my types of problems. The debate on fiscal policy is important but not interesting, because the policy that is being driven by stuff that has clearly whatever is driving our fiscal policy actually solving the economy's problems is not one of the motives. Enough said. I write about that all the time. Just to say that I haven't really talked about Europe at all, and I won't until we get, unless someone asks a question, but that we have our own version of the much denounced stability pact, which is that state and local governments are by and large required to operate on a balanced budget basis. And so we actually have, whatever the federal government is doing, we're having a sharp fiscal contraction at the state and local level, which is quite serious. Okay, if that doesn't work, what can you do? Well, those of us who've written about Japan have more or less reached the view that if you can somehow commit, if the central bank can somehow commit to really following an inflationist policy, convince people that it will create and validate a situation where you have several percent inflation, so that people who borrow will not find that the real value of their debt is increasing, and that people who hold on to cash will be punished, that you ought to be able to bootstrap yourself out of that kind of slump. The trouble is, it's difficult to do. You have to not only make a credible commitment to following that kind of policy, but you also have to communicate convince people that it's going to happen, not that you're really going, despite the deflation they currently see, that there's inflation in the future. And a lot of clever ideas have been advanced for making that happen, and some of us have been urging the Japanese to at least try one of them, something, anything, and they keep on not doing it, which I guess is, means a certain amount of safety for the theorists. The ideas are never put to the test. But it's something that certainly they should be trying. They should be trying something very hard. And if push comes to shove, I expect that the U.S. will be prepared, that the Federal Reserve will be prepared to do something along those lines. But clearly the best thing is not to be there in the first place. And so I'll end this with a hope that the U.S. Spontaneously has an undeserved recovery which takes us away from this, and let's hope that we don't find ourselves close to it again. Thanks.
Well, we have time for a few questions now. Do I have any questions? Yes. Is there a microphone up there? Sorry. Is there anybody down here with a question where there are...
Oh. There's a microphone slowly making
How
its way
about
there.
The person just behind you, yes, just as being nearest. Okay, well, when we find a microphone, we'll... Yes, please.
How much do you think the present problems are down to the fashion towards balanced budgets, which leads to high capital accumulation in the short run, but then an over capital accumulation in the long run?
Oh, that's... That... How do I think about that? Do I think that the U.S. has got fundamentally too much capital? That's really what it comes down to. It's a little hard to make that case, though it is true that business investment increased very rapidly during the 90s. I doubt that that's the. If you're really going to ask, you know, what made the U.S. over accumulation of capital, if there is one possible, first of all, it would be largely capital inflows from abroad. But I guess I suspect that it's really a case of too much capital in particular sectors rather than across the board. We don't know that for sure, to be honest. A lot of old debates that we thought were settled do get reopened. And the over-saving, over-accumulation stories, the kinds of things that I was brought up to believe were bad heresies from the early crude Keynesians, I guess you have to take a little bit more seriously now. But I guess it's hard to believe that the U.S., which even with all of that, didn't have investment to GDP ratios that were particularly high, really managed to accumulate just too much capital in the 90s. I still think that the balanced budgets of the 90s were probably a good thing, though it's clearly it's good that we're having a deficit now. I just wish that the numbers didn't say that it's going to stay high and then explode, which is what they do now say.
Yeah. What effect the Iraqi reconstruction program will have on U.S. and British economy in terms of what effect the Iraqi reconstruction program will have in U.S. and British economy?
Okay. Oh, I just found one of the problems with the mic is I can't actually, it takes a while to identify where the person's speaking. Iraqi. Magnitudes. These are, I won't talk about the British where I can't rattle the numbers off my head, but you know, we are, U.S. is now spending $3 billion a month in Iraq. Even if it's a major reconstruction program, it might be $75 billion a year, let's say. Not all of that would be U.S. exports, not even most of it, I think. $10 trillion economy, it's just not going to be a very big deal. It's not even a big deal for the U.S. budget deficit, although it's just one more thing that they hid until the tax cut was passed. But it's I think on those terms it's just not a very big deal.
Okay, here.
Two of the responses in the 30s were to raise trade barriers and to devalue currency. Do you see any possibility of that happening globally?
The currency devaluation, I mean, if you have a floating exchange rate, as the U.S. does, then, of course, currency devaluation is sort of part and parcel of monetary policy. It's not a separate policy. Certainly for Hong Kong, where this is really an issue, you would say, gee, you know, there are a lot of reasons why they think that the currency board is a good thing, but it started at this point, the reasons for not maintaining it are getting quite a lot stronger. Trade barriers, it's a, of course, that is a zero-sum game, and if you have, as is currency devaluation, if you have broadly, if you have deflationary pressures across a large swath of the world, then it only redistributes the pain; it doesn't eliminate it. So I think it's not really an answer. And now whether it might happen, whether or not it's a good answer, is a serious possibility. And you have to wonder if we're going to have persistently depressed economies, if we really are stumbling into some version of the 1930s, how long can a relatively open trading system survive? And the answer is probably not too well. But it is a funny situation. I think it was Peter Sutherland. I was at a meeting this morning, and I think Peter Sutherland said that according to his analysis, at this point, all of the world's major currencies need to be devalued. So that's kind of a problem.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think the question was, can't we, looking back, say that, was it a question whether the Japanese should have done something different, or whether it's a question of...
Yeah, essentially, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. My view is that once you're getting anywhere close to the lower bound, the monetary aggregate data cease to be a meaningful indicator, because they're telling you, they're endogenous. They're telling you really what's happening to the economy, not what the central bank is doing. In terms of, for what it's worth, the Fed study, Kamen et al., says, using their simulations, that if the Ministry of Finance had understood, or if it had followed radically more stimulative policies between 1991 and the end of 1994, that Japan would have steered clear, would have skimmed away from the trap in which it now finds itself. So that they claim that it would have been different. Now, from 95 on, there's essentially no, on monetary policy at least, there's essentially no wiggle room. You could have pushed more base money in, but it probably would have had no impact. It would have just done what increases in base money do now, which is just sit there.
Wait.
We'd like...
We've had an equity bubble that's burst. Do you think we're on the brink of a bond bubble that's about to burst? And if we are, what will the economic consequences be?
Okay. I was hoping no one would ask that. I think that there is. Well, I believe that we do have at least a modest bond bubble in the U.S. If you look... Of course, that's based partly on my view that there will eventually be a recovery. That if we do stay, you know, if we really do a full Japan, if we do stay with interest rates at lower bound for a decade, then current bond prices are actually too low. But assuming that there is a recovery eventually, then you have to say there really doesn't seem that. Long-term interest rates do not seem to be reflecting the fiscal situation. There are other things in there as well, but you know, the U.S. I'll just give you my you know, this is the stuff that's not interesting, but it is. But the data are fairly startling. Essentially, the U.S. has a budget deficit now of 4% of GDP that is mostly structural. Roughly speaking, now given the latest tax cut, we get. Collect revenue at the federal level of about 17% of GDP. What it takes to run the U.S. government as it now stands is about 20% of GDP. And that rises steeply once the baby boomers start to retire. So we've locked ourselves into this unsustainable fiscal situation, and you have to imagine that, that there's going to be something nasty happening to interest rates when reality finally sinks in. We often have this discussion, why doesn't the bond market reflect what we all seem to see in the fiscal prospect? My answer is that it's just bond traders simply can't wrap their minds around it. The U.S. is a well-run country and always has sound fiscal policy, and we are not Argentina. And despite the fact that you look at the numbers, we say that we are Argentina, they just can't believe it.
Gosh, there's so many people. Yeah.
Related question, really. What do you think about the plans mooted for so-called unconventional monetary policy measures, specifically the Bonanco and to some extent Greenspan plans for committing to buy treasury bonds to keep long bond yields down if deflation risks are seen to persist?
Well, actually, I've been in that game. You understand, this is a Princeton is a hotbed. Bernanke has just come to the Fed from Princeton. It's been a hotbed of unconventional monetary policy guys. So we've all been talking about this for years now. I think Ben is just itching to have a chance to try it out. There's two kinds of unconventional policy. One is the attempts to affect expectations. The other is basically doing open market operations and things you don't usually do open market operations in. And those are probably, those would be used in tandem. You would say we are trying to get ourselves back up to a 2.5% rate of inflation, and we're also going to try to drive down long-term interest rates by buying up lots of bonds. The trouble I have with those, obviously, if we get to that point, you do try them. The trouble is when you start to think about magnitudes, they become very large. Here's a way I like to think about it. It's easier, it's hard to do this with long-term bonds, but in the case of Japan, one of the alternatives that's been proposed is buying up foreign exchange, essentially doing your open market operations in the foreign exchange market. One way to think about that, sorry, this is getting a little technical, guys, but just bear with me for a moment. One way to think about that is that you're trying to achieve capital outflows greater than the private sector would do on its own by having the government undertake the capital outflows. If you actually ask how much would it take to reflate Japan through that to a reasonable level, it's probably capital outflows of an additional 3 or 4% of GDP, which would mean that which would improve the current account balance by 3 or 4% of GDP. If the government is doing it, the central bank is doing that, it actually has to do interventions in the exchange market presumably much larger than that, because its actions will be partly offset by the private sector. So you're looking at situations where the Central Bank of Japan might be purchasing dollars at the rate of something like 10% of Japanese GDP each year. And you have to think of something comparable in any of these policies, which means we're talking about the Fed buying $1 trillion worth of long-term bonds per year. It can be done, but you start to run out of things to buy, and you start to run into a lot of problems. Now, I have to admit that the U.S. Treasury is busy generating a lot more bonds for the Fed to buy, at the rate of about $400 billion a year at this point. But it's still, you do run into these issues. Look, funny stuff can be done. When you get into this kind of situation, you do it. Think about the Hong Kong Monetary Authority facing a very different problem, but dealing with the hedge funds in 1998, briefly, the HKMA bought up 14% of the Hong Kong stock market. And they appear to have succeeded in doing that without creating any big issues of moral hazard or government mucking around with the capital market. So I guess if need be, the Fed can go out there and buy up 20% of the U.S. stock market in an attempt to keep us afloat. And if all else fails, you do that.
I think just one last question, maybe one in the gallery. And as I say, there will be opportunities afterwards to talk.
What's your view on three different things happening altogether? One, fiscal policy in terms of our money being invested into the economy, plus war happening in other regions of the world, as well as the economy is not doing too well. Is there a possibility that the trust in the U.S. towards an Argentina situation? That's an extreme, but right. A lower covenant?
The possibility of a lot of loss of faith by foreign investors in the U.S. is very real. In fact, to some extent, it's happened already. If you look at the financing of the U.S. current account deficit, you discover that private capital inflows have shrunk to a fraction of what they were. And it's largely foreign central banks. Essentially, the Bank of Japan and the Reserve Bank of China are doing a lot of our current account financing now. And if they should choose to stop doing that or start buying euros instead, the dollar can plunge. Now, what we think, intellectually interesting that's also relevant topics is currency crises, modern currency crises. What we think is that the reason that a plunging currency is so devastating for a place like Argentina or Indonesia is that their external debt, particularly private external debt, is in dollars. And guess what? U.S. external debt is also in dollars, which means that it's your problem, not ours. And so it's very difficult to construct a scenario for the U.S. having an Argentine-style collapse. It's not at all hard to have a scenario where the euro goes to $1.60. But that appears to be only mildly annoying for the U.S. Please, not until we finished our vacation in France, which follows immediately after this lecture. But is catastrophic for Germany. So it's very unfair, but that's the way I think it works at the moment. Okay.
Okay, well, I'm sorry to have had to cut off the questions. We've sort of got an hour, and that's the time we're allowed. So I very much hope that many of you will stay on after the lecture for the drinks reception, which is in the atrium just across the way here, and the opportunity for further discussion there. I very much like the idea of deflation as a sort of looking glass economy. I think the moral from this lecture is that actually there's nothing wrong with deflation. What's the problem is having very low interest rates. And of course, most of us are brought up to sort of think that high interest rates are a bad thing and the low interest rates show the country's doing well. But in this curious world we now live in, the one thing that you want to avoid is having a low interest rate. And I will commend my colleagues on the Monetary Policy Committee for their success in ensuring that that's not happening in this country at any event. Anyway, I think this is indeed a important question, an intellectually fascinating question, a problem that could indeed afflict all our lives, but we hope will not do so. And may we again thank Professor Krugman for an extremely stimulating lecture and fascinating answers to questions. Thank you very much indeed.